Have you ever fallen for a scam? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author this quarter. And with me again are my colleagues, Dave Thomas and Alden Thompson. And we're looking at the book of Revelation. We're in chapter 13. We're in kind of the heart of the book of Revelation. Before we jump into looking at, have either of you fallen for a scam? Have you, or you've come close?
Come close.
Dave, you mentioned a story about a tractor that you'd gone to see that maybe wasn't quite what had been advertised. And
yeah, that was actually a big truck.
A big truck.
Yeah, and I was trying to find one for a friend of mine, and the guy had a nice truck for a good price. And when I chased down the phone number, it got sent to somebody else and somebody else, and finally I found out the truck was not even in the state where it was advertised, and they wanted money to help transport the truck. I told them, look, forget about it. I'm the buyer. I'm not the seller.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. How about you, Alden? Have you ever, or are you too suspicious?
I don't know that I've ever been caught by a scam.
Yeah, I don't think I have really either. That doesn't mean to say we won't, though.
Yeah, they become more sophisticated all the time. Some of them, the emails that come across are just too blatantly obvious. But it seems like people are out there to pretend they're one thing when they're actually something else to get people's money. You know, in chapter 13, we're looking at two beasts. It says at the beginning of chapter 13, the dragon who we saw last week, who's chasing after the woman. He can't get to the woman, the church, so he goes after her offspring. And then he runs off. And instead of going to make war by coming and confronting the woman, he goes and he gets a couple allies. First, he gets a beast out of the sea, and then he gets a beast out of the land. These beasts have historically been looked at in a couple different ways. If you lived in the first century, there's no doubt you would have looked at the beast here out of the sea and said, yeah, this looks like some kind of an incarnation of Rome itself and the power of the emperor forcing worship and that sort of thing. It would have been difficult for Christians living in the first century to survive in the Roman government, certainly. And as time went on, the reformers at the end of the Dark Ages looked at this passage and said, well, this certainly seems to be, this beast out of the sea certainly seems to be the Antichrist, and that would be the very church out of which we came. And so they pinpointed the Roman Catholic pontiff, the Pope, and the system of church-state power in the Dark Ages. Seventh-day Adventists, of course, have inherited that view to some degree, to a greater or lesser degree. But there's more to this passage, and perhaps if we look at it in the context of, as we've been talking about this quarter, a cosmic controversy, we may actually see that the beast out of the sea and the beast out of the land are deliberate attempts to counterfeit the ministry of Jesus Christ and that of the Holy Spirit in the world, that there is a intentional counterfeit to try and scam people into false worship and a false sense of ideology where God is concerned. So these two beasts, beast out of the sea, beast out of the land. The first one, he shows up and it says that he has seven heads and 10 horns. Who does that look like? Seven heads and 10 horns. Where have we seen this before? Does this remind you of anything?
Book of Daniel.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was trying to think in Revelation.
Yeah, well, in Revelation, the dragon in chapter 12 also has seven heads and 10 horns, but it says that this beast, yeah, has some features in, is it verse 2 here? We see a leopard, a bear, a lion. Where have we seen these before?
That's in Daniel.
The different beasts in Daniel 7.
But here, they're all put together to make one beast.
A composite beast.
A composite beast, right. And so this beast is made up of kind of the nations of the world, at least the historical nations that have oppressed Israel. And yet he also, as a composite beast, looks a lot like the dragon, right? It also says the dragon gives him his throne. Well, in the book of Revelation, chapter 12, we saw last week that God, the Father, gives Jesus Christ the throne and the kingdom. So here we have a beast who's following after his father, the dragon, and he's given a throne. Do you have any sense on how long Jesus' ministry was? Do we know about how long?
Well, officially, I think 3.5 years or thereabouts.
Do we have any? I don't know that we have any textual markers specifically that say it was 3.5 years, right?
No, but I think scholars have figured out it was pretty close to that.
Yeah, I think the Gospel of John mentions a few Passovers that give us an indication it's about that long. This beast has a ministry, or a ministry, if we can use that word. It's a 3.5 year time of power, but it's given to us in prophetic time, you know, an odd way of thinking, 1260 days, or time times and a half a time, or 42 months. So it's about the same time as Jesus had his ministry. It also says he had a fatal wound that gets healed. What do you call it when you have a wound that kills you, but you get healed from it?
Resurrection.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I would say that's resurrection. So we have a creature here who gets its power from its father, or from the dragon, and it has a 3.5 year time of power, and it has a deadly wound. It dies and is healed. It seems certainly to be a parody of Jesus. But in the end, he speaks blasphemous words, and he opposes the people of God. Is there anything we can learn from perhaps the Adventist understanding of the Dark Ages? What happens when secular power falls into the hands of religious orientation?
Brent,
what
before happens? You go there, it just struck me that this seems to be somewhat analogous to what you see in Daniel 2 and 3, where you have an image that is part of a divine vision given to Nebuchadnezzar, but he doesn't like the vision.
Correct.
And so then he makes an image that's all gold.
Right.
Which is a parody, or it's this is in opposition to the first vision. Okay. And I'm it just struck me when you said that these chapters seem to be structured the same way. If indeed the chapter 12 we're talking about Christ, who are we talking about here? This is counter to chapter 12. It's the not the opposite, but what?
It's the outgrowth. It's the extension.
It's the remaking of it, saying that we don't like chapter 12, so we're going to do chapter 13.
So perhaps the dragon sees his end is short, and his answer to that is, well, I know I'll propagate myself and keep things
he's doing
going.
Doing what Nebuchadnezzar did.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I have a question here, Brant.
Sure.
When one takes the historicist interpretation, where you see this is Rome and even the United States as part of the story. The difficulty I have with that is it seems to be very limited. Is there some way of looking at this chapter so that you're not dependent upon history books? Is there imagery that can be applied anywhere in the world?
And that's why I'm asking the question, you know, what are the big pictures that we take here? If the dragon goes off, we know that Satan has been at war with God and his people throughout time. This is nothing new, right? The desire to snatch up the baby Jesus when he was a boy, that is not the first time that it happened, was it?
No.
That had happened before. That had happened with many of the children of the patriarchs, right? We see that happen with Moses. So we know history repeats itself. We know that happens. We know the dragon works the same way, and we know God works the same way.
Well, it doesn't really repeat itself, Brent, but the same dynamic appears over and over again.
Maybe that's the way to put this. So when I look at this beast out of the sea, and the beast out of the sea is doing the things that Nero did in the first century, and I see him doing what the Roman papacy did in the Dark Ages, and then I think, well, where's that happening today? Or where could that happen today? All of a sudden, it opens it up much broader. Then I have to learn, yes, the lessons of history, but the lessons of history are to warn me about what's coming.
And see, it is a fascinating truth in history that wherever an ideology, and it might be religious or it might be non-religious, wherever it manages to seize the civil power, somebody's going to pay dearly for dissent. Okay, if you don't agree, I mean, you can look at this over and over again when there's regime change, especially those that are totalitarian. Every desire for a human utopia has come at the cost of millions of lives, see? So.
Well, and this is the challenge with chapter 13, is the story it's telling. And maybe, Alden, it's not an answer to your question, perhaps, but the big picture is that we, in all that we can do, we should resist allowing any ideology to have power that does not give humans freedom to live and be and think differently than it does.
And well, when you look at Revelation 13, 14, maybe 12 as well, there are two key factors that identify the bad boys. That's coercion
mm-hmm.
and deception.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that wherever that shoe fits throughout the world, one could make the application.
Certainly. I wouldn't want to. I think I have seen even bosses in companies that act beastly. Certainly that's the case.
And actually, I like what you're saying. It doesn't rule out the historical interpretation.
Not at all.
It expands it and points out that this conflict is not just between Rome and Washington, D.C. It's a global concern. The people of God are everywhere in the world, but it also has a cosmic dimension. And so what you gentlemen have talked about here, I think, as I say, does not dishonor the historical Protestant interpretation, but it wants to expand it to apply it to the whole world, not just to two players.
Well, it's very Absolutely. Interesting how the book of Revelation itself describes it. It never mentions Rome.
No.
It talks about Babylon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's why I like the phrase applied historicism. You take those characters and describe them, and then you say wherever that applies, that is another way of looking at it. So you get a both-and approach, and I think that's maybe the healthiest way to look at Scripture like this.
And especially if we go back to the seven churches, you'll notice each one of the seven churches ends with the words, whoever has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. You're not supposed to listen to, oh, well, Laodicea is for my time, so that's the only one I'll listen to. There is a sense in which this passage on the beast would have been understood in the first century.
Yeah.
And I cannot dismiss their understanding because Rome in the first century certainly acted the same way.
It was beastly.
Absolutely. And then we have to say, will there be that same characteristic at the end? Revelation suggests that's the case.
Yeah. And I mean, the words of Jesus about a time of trouble are very clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
But he never identifies the players.
Right. And so we come down to the second beast. Our time is almost up, but I want to mention the beast out of the land. There's a second beast, and this one has two horns like a lamb, but speaks like a dragon, which means that he also is tied to the dragon in chapter 12. It says that he can call fire down out of heaven in the presence of men. This is frightening because if I remember what happened on Mount Carmel, they said, whoever can rain fire down, he is truly God. Now, instead of it being the true God, it's a false God. And also we have a tie to the book of Daniel, chapter 3, with an image being set up and coercion to worship. And if you don't worship the image, you will die.
Mm.
Certainly we have an allusion to Daniel chapters 2 and 3, Alden, as you brought up earlier. I wish we could go into this more. We could talk about the mark of the beast, the number of man, the man's creation on the sixth day, and all that is man-made worship. Sadly, our time is up. Next week, we'll be jumping into the next couple chapters, chapter 14 and into 15. For now, my thanks to all of you who are listening into the Good Word, and thank you to Jared Miller, our sound engineer, and Alden and Dave, I appreciate our conversations as always. Please join us again next week in our study of Revelation. For the Good Word, I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.